Ilya Shapiro and Josh Blackman are long-lost brothers who found each other as grown-ups. At least it seems that way sometimes. Mr. Shapiro is Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute, and he is Editor-in-Chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. His law degree is from the University of Chicago, and he clerked for the Honorable E. Grady Jolly of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Before joining Cato, Mr. Shapiro worked at Cleary Gottlieb and at Patton Boggs, and he was an adjunct professor at George Washington University Law School. He has contributed to many academic, popular, and professional publications. He regularly provides commentary for various television and radio outlets, and he appeared on the Colbert Report in the wake of McDonald. And if you, I sent you a link. If you haven't watched it, you should.
Wait a minute,
I got
ready. We can actually just play it.
Mr. Blackman, again, is a law clerk in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit for Danny Boggs. His law degree is from George Mason. He has published 12 law review articles, was cited by the Seventh Circuit in Izzell versus Chicago, and will begin as an assistant professor at South Texas College of Law in August 2012. Their topic this afternoon is Justice Thomas's concurrence in McDonald, what it, and therefore the Privileges or Immunities Clause, means for future right to bear arms related litigation.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for having us. It's been a little while since we've done this routine. And possibly, I guess we did it once maybe after McDonald, but most of what we were doing was before McDonald and the run-up to it, because exactly 2 years ago we published an article called Keeping Pandora's Box Sealed, about the proper way, we were arguing was the proper way to extend the right to keep and bear arms to the states, which is the Privileges or Immunities Clause. In fact, in the academic literature there is no doubt this is not a controversial point as far as whether you're a conservative, a libertarian, or a progressive, the
darling of the story.
That's right. That's right. As Scalia put during the argument, but it's really kind of a it's baffling to me that this whole argument about the Privileges and Immunities Clause, incorporation, the meaning of rights, the 14th Amendment, has come about via gun rights. I think at lunch somebody mentioned Northeastern sensibilities. Well, I mean, I'm a Russian Canadian Jew, grew up in Toronto. I really didn't have much exposure to guns. It's not like the wilds of Staten Island that Josh grew up in. I never expected to be invited to talk at NRA things and stuff like that. Not that I've ever been opposed to gun rights or self-defense, quite to the contrary, but it's just wasn't and still isn't really how I conceive of myself. As I like to say, I'm not a gun nut, I'm a Constitution nut. And so when Josh came to me over 2 years ago with a theory of, hey, this this thing that Alan Gura and the stuff that's bubbling up, this is a great way to reconceive all this stuff that you at Cato, I've been at Cato, I guess, 2 years at that point, have been pushing in terms of the restoring the lost Constitution and reconceiving our rights and overturning Slaughterhouse, these sorts of things. And at the same time, tearing a strip off the progressive vision of the Constitution in 2020 project. So that's how this came about. We wanted to mollify as much as we could conservative fears about opening the Pandora's box of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. If we incorporate or apply the right to keep and bear arms through privileges or immunities, well, conservative sphere, doesn't that mean that government then has to not just allow but require triplet gay marriage in federal post offices or, whatever.
With midgets.
With midgets, yeah, well, yeah, that's, I'm not sure if that's a protected class or not. But, that's what our project was, saying, look, this is the more faithful, originalist way of doing it, and it's at worst no worse than this nebulous, I know it when I see it, substantive due process, what is a fundamental right on principle.
Which did that the Supreme Court did.
Well, not quite. We'll get into that. But anyway, before I turn it over to Josh, let me just say that I believe this is the first time we're doing this song and dance when both Josh has had a full night's sleep and I'm sober. So we'll see how that
The last time we did this was in New Orleans and we had spent the night on.
No, 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 it was at Georgetown.
Oh, right, okay, so we did twice. We did it once in New Orleans.
Anyway, get to the stuff.
Bourbon Street, and the last time actually.
We didn't do it on Bourbon Street.
Well, speak for yourself.
It's only,
that's actually a good segue. And the second time I did this, I actually camped out outside the Supreme Court on arguments from McDonald's in Chicago. I slept on the sidewalk. It is very cold. I actually have some sympathy for the occupiers as I did that for one night, but thankfully I'll never do it again. So, where are we? McDonald's in Chicago. This all starts really way back when with people like Joyce Malcolm and Don Cates in the 80s who had this great idea that the Second Amendment protects individual rights. And these are living legends in our midst. And they really set the intellectual groundwork which brought us to the present. 2008, D.C. v. Heller. The Supreme Court said, surprise, the Second Amendment means something. We have this individual right to keep and bear arms. Okay, but it only applied to this little federal enclave we find ourselves in now. It only applied to the District of Columbia. So what happens next? Literally within minutes of Heller, one of Alan Gurr's associates filed suit in Chicago, saying that the Chicago ban on firearms is unconstitutional. It was one of those draconian in the nation. And that suit percolated through. And the way Alan styled his complaint was in two factors. As we all know, the Constitution, as originally written, only applied to the federal government. It didn't apply to the states. This is Barron v. Baltimore. In the after the ratification of the 14th Amendment, rights started to be incorporated or extended to the states. And the Supreme Court did like a hodgepodge of pros. Some justices said all of them are in, some justices said some of them are in. And they made all these silly testing. It was implicit in the concept of order and liberty, for it's deeply rooted in our traditions. It applies to the state. Fine. Since the court has never recognized the Second Amendment as meaning anything, it never addressed the incorporation issue. And that was really what happened to McDonald. So leading up to McDonald, there was a resurgence of looking at history. Now we're not talking about what James Madison and George Mason and Thomas Jefferson thought about guns, we're looking at what John Bingham and the 38th Congress thought about guns. And this is really an important distinction which the court somewhat adheres to. The history that was relevant for the original inquiry of McDonald wasn't 1787, it was 1868. How did people perceive of the right to keep their arms at the time? And there's one very important clause in the Constitution that's relevant. And if you've ever taken common law, you'll think the relevant provision for incorporations is due process clause, and you're wrong. The relevant provision is the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which reads, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Now, you must ask, what is a privilege or immunity? What is this? Well, there's a couple ways we can find out, one of which is you look to Article 4 of the Constitution, which has both Privileges and Immunities Clause. And that was given a very early explication by Justice Bushrod Washington, a nephew of President George Washington, in a very famous case called Corville v. Coryell, which was about raking oysters in Connecticut. I don't eat oysters. He does. And see, last time in New Orleans, there was a lot of seafood, so I didn't fare too well. So this you know, some lobster was actually pretty good. So anyway, we look at this case of Corville v. Coryell. So Justice Washington said, what are these privileges and immunities?
My view comprehends both lox and oysters. So,
need some bagels to wrap this up. So Washington said that what are these privileges and immunities? They're these broad kind of natural rights that include enjoyment of life and liberty. You know, think of Jefferson and Declaration of Independence. The right to acquire and possess property, it's kind of a locking thing. And the right to pursue happiness and safety. This is Jeffersonian Declaration of Independence. And there are these broad natural rights. Now, the Privileges and Immunities Clause didn't really protect them the same way. But when they ratified the 14th Amendment, there was a real need to protect the rights of people in the states. Because look at the times. It was Reconstruction. The South had just lost a war, and they were basically denying freedmen of their both basic fundamental rights. So one of the reasons why the Privileges or Immunities Clause came was a way to protect substantive rights. And what are these rights? They go back to what Corporal Coryell said. And perhaps, literally for our purposes, one of the things that everyone agreed at in 1868 was privilege or immunity of citizenship was the right to bear arms. Think of yourself if you're a freeman in, say, somewhere in the Deep South after the Civil War and the Ku Klux Klan was riding through, there was no police to help you because probably most of the police officers were part of the Klan. The only way you could defend yourself was with a gun. And the framers of the 14th Amendment were very clear. And Justice Thomas's concurrence, which we'll get to in a bit, was very profound on the saying that this is an important aspect of citizenship. You need to be able to defend yourself. So this is one of the privileges or immunities of citizenship. I'll talk quickly about the slaughterhouse and I'll go back to you. So we have this great clause, this Privileges or Immunities Clause, that protects these fundamental rights. And, you know, it's gung-ho, we got liberty. And then it got slaughtered in the slaughterhouse case. It was a really bizarre case also from New Orleans. And actually, I wanted to visit the slaughterhouse. It's actually right across the river. And I didn't get a chance to go there, but I got a picture of it. So there was this case called the slaughterhouse case where it was basically the city of New Orleans passed a law saying that if you want to slaughter meat, you have to do it in our butcher. In our slaughterhouse, which had the effect of putting all the ones out of business. It was know, for George Bizkie, what was monopolistic rent-seeking law. You got to keep everything in the province of the state. You pay us, bam. It was a stupid law. And a bunch of butchers saying, hey, you can't do this. This violates our right to earn an honest living. IJ is across the river, but this was their bailiwick. They said, this is our right to earn a free living. And the Supreme Court in a 5-4 opinion said, no, this isn't right. You know,
which, by the way, is another one of the rights that Congress was concerned about in terms of the freedmen and the freed slaves. And it's not just a nominal freedom. They had to be able to earn a living, protect themselves, all these different things.
And contract, and you say liberty of contract, it's a nebulous thing. Actually, the freedmen couldn't sign a contract. They couldn't actually engage in business transactions with others. But going back to Slaughterhouse, the very infamous 5-4 opinion that everyone thinks is wrong, even like Akil Maher, who's no friend of the Second Amendment, he thinks it's wrong. And he basically said, the court basically said that the privileges or use clause only protects these so-called federal rights. It doesn't protect any kind of fundamental natural type rights. For example, one of the rights listed is you have the right to visit the sub-treasuries. You have the right to protection on the high seas. I mean, they're stupid. Basically, he read a clause out of the Constitution in Slaughterhouse cases. And then so effectively, this clause was dead. And the court, in order to protect substantive liberty, turned to the clause, I told you, doesn't really matter, but it's the due process clause, which by its term speaks of process, but the court had to imbue it with a substantive
clause. It's not completely directive of substance, because you can't just have cantering
courts.
Much
like Lilly's articles.
You can't just have kangaroo courts that are enforcing due process, but because Slaughterhouse eviscerated privileges or immunities, we have this warped conception of what the due process clause protects. It's kind of unprincipled, unmoored from text and history. And for more on what the due process clause actually does protect, if not nothing, there is little bits of substance to, again, prevent the kangaroo courts. I recommend an article by Tim Sandifer in the New York Journal of Law and Liberty, NYU Journal of Law and Liberty, from 2 years ago.
Yeah, it all goes back to Magna Carta, the law of the land, the notion that there's a substance component to process, but that's Sandifer's argument. But essentially, because the court was able to protect these fundamental rights and privileges and immunities, they said, okay, what's next? And they just, the 14th Amendment, written the next sentence, okay, due process. And throughout the 20th century, rights protected through the due process laws. And that was probably wrong as an originalist matter, but we now have 8 years of precedent. Now bring us back to the future, and we go 88 miles per hour right at the Supreme Court, and we see that the Supreme Court is considering the incorporation of a right, and they haven't done this in a few decades. The last one, I think, was in the 70s or something.
69, Benton versus Maryland.
Bob DeWalt is a man. He knows these numbers. So the court hasn't done this in quite some time, so they were confronted with this, and Allen and others, and people, Cato and elsewhere, saying, okay, we have a chance to perhaps give the privileges of use clause some meaning. Let's restore its original meaning. We have Thomas, we have Scalia, we have Roberts, we have kind of Alito, we have these originalists in the court, and we have a shot to do this. And that's why we wrote this article about 2 years ago. That's why my colleagues will pick it up.
And it's important because, of course, the nature of the right to keep our arms is still very much undefined, and so that's what we'll end with. But anyway, the first step in using the privileges or reviving privileges or immunities is understanding that what the 14th Amendment extends to the states, regardless of which clause it is liberty and not clauses. So the 14th, never in the ratification debates do you see talk of, well, we are simply now going to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. Otherwise, the clause would say those first 8 amendments to the Constitution are now applied to the states. Instead, it talks of due process, it talks of privileges or immunities, it talks of equal protection. And to understand what all those mean, and to understand the original public meaning, of course, as Josh alluded, you have to do originalism at the right time, which in this case is 1868, the time of the 14th Amendment's ratification, not 1791. And in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, the term incorporation, as we know it today, would have been seen as a misnomer, a constitutional malapropism, really.
Ilya loves that line.
It misunderstands what the 14th Amendment protected and how it protected against state oppressions. The concept of incorporation itself was anachronistically inserted into our jurisprudence when the court went about doing this selective incorporation that it had to after Slaughterhouse eviscerated privileges or immunities. To the extent the Reconstruction Congress sought to limit the power of the states to infringe certain rights, the 14th Amendment, as I said, didn't merely copy the 1791 understanding of the first 8 amendments in the Bill of Rights. Instead, it sought to protect certain liberties held by the people, what are known as privileges or immunities. Those are synonymous with natural rights, liberties in 19th century speak. from being infringed by the states. And again, in the words of Akeem Lamar, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment means not just more than mechanical incorporation, but also less. So again, it might protect the exact same scope of the right to keep and bear arms as the Second Amendment does. It might protect more, it might protect less. But the Second Amendment is simply the codification of what that right was understood to be in 1791. In 1868, we have to look at what privileges or immunities meant at that time, or whatever the liberties were at that time that the 14th Amendment text was intended to protect.
Think of it almost like a VHS and a DVD. They both got the same content, but they're in different forms. And essentially what people say is, you know, you gotta take a VHS and jump into a DVD player. And that doesn't exactly work. They're very similar, but they're just different in forms. That's a good way to historically think about different sections of the right.
So what does that mean now, if we're trying to apply a particular right or understand how far a particular right extends to the states? Well, a good way of looking at it, we don't have to invent something from whole cloth. I mean, the Washington versus Glucksberg test is pretty good. So we look at whether a particular right is deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions, and figure out what a careful description of that right would be. So, you know, maybe there's a at a point where you can make a salient judgment of whether that is protected. So, you know, in 1868, doing originalism at the right time, was the right to carry a gun down the street protected? Was that considered to be a traditional right that we have?
So I think Kramer shaking said yes, just for us.
Okay, okay, good. Was taking it to in your carriage as you were driving down the street? I mean, all these different things that you could look at. You can't obviously go down to such a fine level of generality as, you know, does it allow 15 bullets rather than 12 in your clip? But we should look at whether, you know, what kind of ammunition was allowed to be carried or bought and sold and so forth. So, you know, the analogy breaks down, but it's imperfect, you know, and in fact, we don't have to fully define, the court doesn't have to fully define at any one time the full scope of that right, the right to keep your arms, or any. But anyhow, when we came to McDonald, you know, and at the same time, the court doesn't have to say that everything that has developed under substantive due process is wrong. It just says, okay, that's our jurisprudence, but we're starting this new line under privilege under immunities, which is a truer, more doctrinally faithful, or what have you. But anyhow, that brings us to McDonald versus Chicago, where there's a circuit split in various courts, the Nordyke case out of the Ninth Circuit, the NRA case out of the Seventh Circuit, and this curious case involving nunchucks out of the Second Circuit. Luckily, the court didn't take that one, because then they would have been, you know, held up on whether nunchucks and arm and all this other
stuff. Not Sotomayor's opinion. She wrote that.
She wrote that opinion, indeed. But the question presented that the Supreme Court ultimately took was Allen's. And that's key, because his part, the McDonald case, as separate from the NRA's case, was whether the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms is incorporated as against the states by the 14th Amendment's privileges or immunities or due process clauses. And in all of the briefing that Allen presented, he put the PRI clause front and center, and that's what the court took. Over Chicago's objections, and more broader than what the NRA and Mr. Holbrook were pushing. Now, I don't want to, you know, bite the hand that feeds me too much, but I think the NRA did not play a helpful role at the Supreme Court stage, because in hiring Paul Clement, who is a good friend of mine, and in fact, I'm making a living right now just commenting and filing briefs in all the cases that Paul Clement has before the Supreme Court. I think it's up to 7 or 8 this term. Certainly all the high-profile ones, yeah. And it's unfortunate that a lot of conservatives, I'll call the conservative position, kind of the NRA position, who are, again, afraid of this, polygamous, midget, gay marriage in federal post offices, didn't want to open up the Pandora's box of privileges or immunities. Even though that the case's outcome validated the concerns about the potential lack of 5 votes for a substantive due process incorporation, there were not 5 votes. The result also demonstrated the utility of an originalist argument in swaying votes even for due process incorporation. And we saw the realized benefits of attracting the support of non-traditional allies, including so-called progressive or new textualist originalists like Doug Kendall and Akeel Amar and Larry Tribe and all of these people. And Jack Balkin, exactly. You know, they agreed that on an originalist approach in certain respects, but You know, ultimately, we did get one vote for it, and...
You're spoiling it. We didn't get there yet.
Oh, we haven't gotten there yet. I guess I'll turn it over to you for discussion of McDonald, what McDonald actually did.
Never go a movie with him. Let's tell you what happened. Ilya, you're not allowed to take any more refreshments in the back. They just actually pulled your funding for some bagels and lox, so you're done. Anyway, so brings us to, was it March 12th, 2009? I think that was the date, or give or take 2 or 3 days. So, you know, I spent the entire night sleeping outside the Supreme Court. It's very cold, and the sprinklers do come on really late at night, even in March. I don't know why. I guess it's to keep the grass green. And I woke up this morning, and Ilya came, because he's a member of the Supreme Court Bar, and strolled in casually. And it was a very interesting case. I won't focus too much on arguments, but we'll focus on the opinions. Like Ilya said, there was not 5 votes for any one position. There were only 4 votes for the right to incorporate through substantive due process. You got 4 votes for saying that the right should not be incorporated, and you had, in the middle, Justice Clarence Thomas saying, nope, not going to join you guys. I'm only going to concur saying the right should be brought to the states through privilege of immunity clause. So let's just go through the opinion. So Justice Alito, not Justice Scalia, the author Peller, with which you can speculate ad infinitum, perhaps you couldn't keep a majority, who knows why. But Alito had a majority, and he basically went through all the history and did all that jazz, and then he had this kind of newfangled incorporation test. Like Bob mentioned before, there really hasn't been an incorporation test since like the late 1960s. So none of the justices were, I think, even like out of law school when that test was concluded. So they really didn't have a solid test of what to do. So there was this PALCO test, which said you incorporate something that's implicit in the concept of our liberty. We had Duncan v. Louisiana, which said it should be incorporated if it's necessary for Anglo-American liberty. We had Glucksberg, which was Ilya and I kind of liked, which said that's been deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition. So, I mean, you got these 3 tests. What are you going to do? I'll just throw them together. So here is the test if a right should be incorporated. Okay? The court must decide whether the right is fundamental to our scheme of order liberty, or as we said in related context, whether the right is deeply rooted in this nation's history and traditions. It basically just jammed together, kind of like a hodgepodge of all different rights. He didn't explain that, and I frankly don't think it matters much, because going forward, there's really not too much more incorporation. One of the few other rights that has been incorporated is the right to a unanimous jury verdict. You might know this, but in Oregon, you can have less than unanimous jury and still be convicted. And there was this bizarre case called Apodaca in the 70s, where there was like a really split plurality opinion, where the court couldn't come up with an opinion. And last year, the court actually just denied certiorari in a case concerning that. So that's the way the court's saying that this is a dead issue. Now, one thing that's most noteworthy is that the court only spent 172 words on Justice Thomas's concurring opinion. They didn't refute it because they couldn't. It wasn't ground to. They just said stuff like, we declined to disturb slaughterhouse. You know what's wrong? You know, it's water on the bridge.
None of the justices ended up, not the plurality, not the dissenters, ended up disputing anything that Thomas said. What the plurality did, I mean, first, Justice Scalito acknowledged that, quote,
you said Scalito.
There are two different people, you know.
So first, Justice Alito said that, quote, many legal scholars dispute the correctness of the narrow slaughterhouse interpretation. Well, of course, this is an understatement akin to noting that, you know, many astrophysicists believe the Earth is essentially round and revolves around the sun. But nevertheless, this was an important step in overcoming the slaughterhouse court's medieval work view, as it were, of privileges or immunities.
Right, and so that was Alito's opinion. And I mean, it's long, it's originalist, maybe it was Scalia, maybe it was Alito, it doesn't really matter who wrote it, but the fact is they didn't touch CRI because they couldn't. They didn't have a good argument.
Another thing that Alito said, why he didn't touch, and why the plurality didn't touch slaughterhouse or PRI was, because scholars who think slaughterhouse was wrong are unable to arrive at, quote, a consensus on the question about the scope of unenumerated rights. Why they need to figure out the full scope of this is beyond me. Because, no, I mean, it's like, to continue the metaphor, I mean, astrophysicists adopting the, you know, Earth is round, the Copernican view rather than the Ptolemaic, still disagree among themselves regarding whether, for example, Pluto is a planet. Or what have you. I mean, you don't need to, in no Supreme Court case does the court say, and here is the full extent and consequences of the doctrine that we're announcing today. They decide things case by case. It's just a bizarre treatment because they didn't want to deal with it.
Right, and if you look at any of the substantive right cases in the 60s or 70s, courts always move in slow increments. They start slow, they define the rights, and they go to court, blah, blah, blah. So it was just a specious argument, but they didn't want to touch it because it was water under the bridge. So Scalia's opinion was more or less just a punch in the back to John Paul Stevens as he left the court, saying that you're wrong, living originalism is wrong, have a nice trip, see you next fall, I won't read your book. And also.
But note the contradiction between Scalia's concurrence and his opinion in Stop the Beach Renourishment, the judicial takings case, where he excoriated Kennedy for using substantive due process to get at that property right claim rather than judicial taking, a novel, rediscovered theory. So Trevor Burrus and I wrote a large article about that called Scalia's Shifting Sands. So, Scalia is not the most consistent person.
No, in fact, he only spent 55 words, that's it, discussing why he's agreeing to go through substantive due process even after calling it like the most evil thing, babble. His entire crusade against substantive due process in the last almost three decades has been so strong. And he just kind of just shooed it away in 55 words, which I...
We'll just have to get over it, Josh.
Get over it. Dudes, get over it. It's fine. And then speaking of getting over it, you can go to Justice Breyer, who hasn't gotten over it.
He hasn't even gotten over Heller.
No, he hasn't. But let me go back to Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas's opinion, as we said, was concurring in judgment only, meaning without this fifth vote, the case would have been dead. We would have some bizarre situation where the second applies to D.C. but not to the states, or been some anomalous holding. So Thomas said, I believe this case presents an opportunity to reexamine and begin the process of restoring the meaning of the 14th Amendment agreed upon by those who ratified it. And this is an originalist opinion at the right time. He went through the entire history of the antebellum South and what the right to bear arms meant to the freemen, how they could protect themselves and the rights and the liberties from the marauding clan. He opined the privileges of use clause, said this is a superior alternative, and that returning to this meaning will give the 14th Amendment its original meaning. He also rejected all substantive due process, which we still have to see how he handles the next substantive due process case, because he said it's all baffling. He went on the ledge, because I think there's...
But except when it's not, Josh, you're forgetting that.
Oh, right. Well, it is when it is. He talked about corpus corporeal, he talked about the privileges of use, term of art. He left open the issue of unenumerated rights, including the right to earn a living. That was the very right at issue in the Slaughterhouse case. And so that might give some hope to our friends at IJ and elsewhere about using PRI as a tool going forward. Justice Stevens had a dissent, and as I say, one is the loneliest number. No one joined him. Even in Heller, Breyer dissented and Stevens dissented. They both, shook hands, they joined each other's dissent. McDonald, no one joined Stevens' dissent. It's somewhat bizarre. He tries to resurrect Justice Harlan's incorporation method from a dissent in Fogey Olin, which no justice ever accepted, but he said is clearly established from court law. And Stevens also went through his alternative reading of the history of the Second Amendment. And really, it was just kind of a back and forth between Justice Scalia, and then they waged this war, and I guess Scalia outlived Stevens, or I don't know which. Scalia won. So I think this was kind of a valedictory dissent, and no one joined it. Now we get to Justice Breyer. And I didn't talk too much about Justice Breyer earlier today, but it's really his pragmatic style arguments, I think, really represent the next wave of what we need to discuss. I think Scalia has provided a sufficient intellectual and historical counterweight to Breyer's recitation of fact, but I don't think we've actually done a good job countering Breyer's arguments that the Second Amendment is different from all the forms of substantive liberty, that it puts others at risk. That's why I think discussion of the social cost of the Second Amendment, both with respect to safety of society and both with respect to individual liberty, is an important discussion. But that's for another topic. So Breyer made three points. He said, Heller's wrong, which is somewhat bizarre because Supreme Court justices are supposed to be bound by their own precedent. I mean, during her confirmation hearing, Justice Sotomayor, when asked by Heller, said it is the law of the land. And then, a couple months later, she joined opinion saying it's not. So, I don't know, think of that. That was actually Dave Koppel's. I think she had a piece in the Washington Times, but give credit. There we go. So he said, Heller's wrong. But even assuming that Heller was right, just arguendo, as our lawyers are off to do, he said the Second Amendment should not be incorporated. And then he gave historical arguments about why it's different from all other rights. I think that's, Manish and Ahalala said, why is this right different from all their rights? It's not. Rights are dangerous. Speech is dangerous. Brand is dangerous. You have dangerous rights.
Exclusionary rules, right?
The exclusionary rules. Actually, the first sentence of the article is also why is this right different from all other rights? I got some bit of feedback on it. I think it's a good point. And finally, Breyer made the point of putting everything else aside, more people will die.
Think of the children.
And that's really the argument that Breyer is making, that history is irrelevant to him. I mean, he cites some history and he says, well, my historians are smarter than your historians, Carl Bogus is more smart than Stephen Halberg. I mean, you can just argue about that all day. But, his point came down to pragmatism. How should we evaluate the social implications with multi-factor balancing tests? And now my illegal. Yeah.
Well, so
your
why
brother.
Did we go? Sorry.
Your brother.
Right. So why did we go through all this? I mean, did we assume that none of you read McDonald or sort of forgotten about it? No. There's a future of this Second Amendment litigation, obviously, which has been covered by other people and will be. Violent misdemeanors, the gun range in Chicago, emergency restrictions or restrictions in times of emergency. Legislators being gun designers that if your barrel is at such and such an angle, it's okay, but if not, it's an assault weapon. The size of your clips, all these different things are, you know, obviously have the third wave of litigation, right? You know, the only two Supreme Court precedents now are Heller and McDonald, which don't say very much to this. But the opinions in McDonald obviously are very important. And here's why Justice Thomas's opinion lives on, because again, it's a necessary, it wasn't some outlying superfluous concurrence, it wasn't a solo dissent, it was the necessary fifth vote. So, you know, game on, as Rick Santorum would say, with respect to the privileges or immunities clause. And indeed, as Josh and I wrote in an op-ed after McDonald was decided, this is a way to use guns to protect liberty and the broader things. I mean, all of this Second Amendment litigation, again, with due respect to the NRA and protecting gun rights, is almost beside McDonald's point. The right at issue here, the one triggering, as it were, this fascinating seminar on corporation doctrine, involved guns. But nowhere in McDonald will you find a discussion of, as I said, the constitutionality of licensing or registration requirements, concealed carry, firearm or ammunition purchasing limits, assault weapon bans, and so forth. Much like Heller, which only decided the Second Amendment protected an individual right not connected to militia service, McDonald, quote, merely said that this right, whatever its scope, offered protection against all levels of government. In neither case did the court even attempt to sketch out the line between constitutional and unconstitutional gun laws. But that's not surprising nor disappointing, because it wasn't asked to. That wasn't the case or controversy before it. What makes McDonald interesting and significant, therefore, isn't what it said about the right to keep and bear arms or incorporation of that right against the states. Both of those things were pretty much foregone conclusions. But precisely Justice Thomas's concurrence, what it said about rights generally, and this is, again, where my main interest is. What rights do we have, and how do we come to have them? Which constitutional provisions protect them? If we accept that the Constitution protects rights that aren't explicitly enumerated, as we must if we're to give effect to the Ninth Amendment, if it's something other than an ink blot, then what's the scope of those unenumerated rights, and which state laws are now in jeopardy? These are the real questions that are McDonald's progeny.
McDonald's children, like they're all McDonald's children.
Yes. So again, in stirring passages detailing the state oppressions before and after the Civil War, Thomas showed the reasons for the Civil Rights Act of 1866 and then the 14th Amendment. Freed slaves needed guns to defend themselves, sure, which is partly why extending the right to keep and bear arms is so important. But as I said before, they also needed the freedom to secure employment in a variety of professions, to keep the fruits of their labors, and to engage in economic transactions, the contracts of their profession. These sorts of rights don't appear explicitly in the text of the 14th Amendment. But in reviewing the speeches of the framers and the ratifiers in 1868, at the right time, you find that unenumerated rights were very much understood to be constitutionally protected. And so Justice Thomas's forceful scholarly opinion will influence litigation that has lots to do with the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, sure, but even more to do with broader rights, like those economic liberties that Slaughterhouse disparaged and that were subverted by the infamous Caroline Products footnote 4. So every complaint challenging the capricious laws impeding the fundamental right to earn a living, such as arbitrary licensing restrictions and other irrational barriers to entry, will now cite Thomas's McDonald concurrence. His opinion will also strengthen challenges to the pervasive regulatory state of all kinds that has unintended consequences on the right to keep and bear arms, among other rights. So when you think about it, and quite apart from the overarching question about the scope of federal power, legislation such as TARP and Obamacare and Dodd-Frank and the rest of it offends a host of unenumerated rights protected by the Privileges or Immunities Clause as well. Significantly, even though Alito didn't adopt Thomas's approach, even though the plurality didn't, he took great pains not to reject or criticize it. And McDonald as a whole thus represents a crucial first step down the path to constitutional liberty, and opens the door, not to Pandora's box, but to reviving a powerful constitutional provision. Thomas's clarion call for a liberty-focused originalism provides a foundation on which to build. And this isn't just, you know, some libertarian crusade or party line that I'm expounding, because look, in Supreme Court history, solo or minority opinions that introduce novel ideas often start with a trickle. These arguments swirl and strengthen and eventually flow into a sea change of constitutionalism. Look no further than John Marshall Harlan's opinion in Plessy versus Ferguson, which argued that separate is not equal. That, of course, became Brown v. Board. Or Justice Owen Roberts' opinion in Hague versus CIO, which has become canonical within First Amendment law regarding free speech rights in the public square. Or Griswold versus Connecticut. I mean, this isn't just, you know, rock-ribbed conservative red meat rights. Justice White was the only one who squarely held that a state ban on the sale of contraceptives deprived married couples of substantive liberty under the Due Process Clause. Or Justice Robert Jackson in the Steele seizure case, right? His concurrence has now become the framework by which the president's foreign policy powers are judged. And law students 25 years from now might similarly look back to Justice Thomas's opinion in McDonald as most akin to Justice Lewis Powell's opinion in Batty, right, the University of California case, which unfortunately allowed race to play a factor in university admissions, and 25 years later led to Grutter. You know, hopefully Justice Thomas's opinion won't lead to some sort of, you know, 25-year arbitrary protection of certain rights. But, you know, again, that is the precedent here. In one respect, Thomas's position in McDonald is even more noteworthy than Harlan's was in Plessy. Or Powell's in Bakke, because Thomas represented the decisive fifth vote for a majority judgment rather than the dissent or superfluous concurring vote. And so in this one opinion, Justice Thomas has shown the way for the Privileges or Immunities Clause, long hidden under the constitutional floorboards, to protect our most fundamental freedoms, including and certainly not limited to the right to keep and bear arms.
I actually completely agree with Justice Thomas's concurrence on the Privileges or Immunities Clause, but I would point out there's two reasons why I can see why NRA played it safe and made the due process argument, and also why the justices were generally reluctant to go down what is clearly, which I think they even acknowledged, at least privately, is the right path. And that is, think of all of the tremendous number of decisions that have been made based on due process, and now imagine what happens. It would be the Full Employment Act for the rest of time for American lawyers re-litigating the claim of, well, if due process wasn't really the right way to apply this to the states, you have to reapply it through privileges or immunities. Privileges or immunities applies to citizens, whereas due process applies to people.
There's also equal protection applies to persons. You can wrap that around.
Right.
I think that's a fair point. But I don't know why you would have to disturb the precedents. In fact, in Thomas's opinion, it makes it clear you don't have to disturb those precedents. I mean, there's lots of precedents which are probably on shaky ground. I mean, the court was only originalist, you know, until like 5 years ago or something. So there are a lot of precedents which are not grounded in originalism, and I don't see, like, you know, motions for TROs trying to
but
stop.
But Justice Kagan said we're all originalists now.
More religions, what does originalism mean?
Well, I mean, it really comes down to stare decisis. Just by deciding this under PRI and making it more textually faithful doesn't mean that you overturn the other things simply because they're wrong. I mean, there's huge reliance interests, obviously. But moreover, in terms of preventing judicial mischief, to the extent that substantive due process allows, you know, I made fun of the polygamous midget gay marriage and federal post offices and so forth, but, you know, whether it be gay marriage, whether it be, you know, whatever your most horrific example of a right that shouldn't be guaranteed by the Constitution, there's much more leeway for, you know, you get some court 100 years from now that you know, will just find that by scratching their chin to be fundamental, versus if you do it under the Privileges or Immunities Clause, where there actually is a textual and contextual and historical base, at worst, it's no worse.
Well, I agree with you. I'm just saying Lawrence v. Texas, for example, would not survive. 32 and 37 states had criminalized all oral and anal sex.
I'm going to call a halt to this purely because I'm so exhausted, and I got to have a little bit of a break. So
do we have time for David? Sure.
David,
sure. Two brief points.
Well, both David hands up.
One is Clayton's hypothetical or thought actually, I think, plays a role in reality. I spoke to the former dean of the University of Arizona Law School, and she said before the oral argument, they had Scalia there, And she spoke with Scalia about the pending McDonald case, and he had some vague interest. And then she said, you do realize that going to privileges and immunities, corporations are not citizens, and therefore will have no incorporated rights. And Scalia looked back at her and said, that's absurd. So that's not entirely theory. That may have been at the heart of the case, or at least in his opinion. The same thing is, of course, in the Heller dissents assume that the right to bear arms is linked to empowering states to offer military resistance to the national government if they feel it's necessary. That may have been a large part of the motivation of the framers of 1789, but how do you attribute it to the framers in the Reconstruction Congress? Because that sounds a whole lot like what had just happened between 1861 and 1865.
Yes.
I'd suggest that understanding was about as likely in the Reconstruction Congress as their intention of putting a statue of Jefferson Davis in the rotunda, making Robert E. Lee's birthday a national holiday.
Which is why the individual right to keep and bear arms was stronger in 1868 than it was in 1791.
Yep. And Dave Koppel for the win? Yeah. I'll try to speak quickly to wrap up your son Dallas. I agree with 97% of what you said, but would have
gone that. Agree with that.
That due process is not as protecting substantive rights is not as crazy as Justice Scalia and perhaps you suggested. It's no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. You can go all the way back to Justice Chase's opinion in Calder versus Bull in the 1790s, in which he says if you have a law that is, if the legislature said we're going to take A's property and give it to B, that would obviously be unconstitutional, so I could scarcely even call it a law. The point is there are some things the government does which may have all the procedural correctness of how a legislature should do things, but simply by the substantive nature of their content can't be law, and that's why when the Supreme Court did what is today incorrectly called incorporation, its first step of incorporating, that's how Jordan describes it, the Fifth Amendment's takings clause against the states in Chicago versus Burlington and Quincy Railroad in 1897, they never mentioned the Fifth Amendment. They were making the point that when you're taking the Burlington Quincy Railroad's property and giving it to somebody else, namely themselves, that can't be due process of law because it can't be law. That's all been sort of forgotten by many, except Richard Epstein. These days, but it's, the point is the Supreme Court's early decisions, which are called incorporation decisions, including Gitlow incorporating the first part of the First Amendment in the 1920s, never even thought about whether it's not the point of the First Amendment, it's that the same right that is protected in the First Amendment is by the nature of due process of law, protected by due process of law. The First Amendment had never been written, it would still be protected. And actually, I think Justice Stevens' point makes that very well in his dissent is significantly correct when he says if the Second Amendment had never been written, people would still have a right to have guns and to use them for self-defense. Although it then makes the error say it can be substantially, that lots of local restrictions are okay within his concept of due process. Secondly, I guess I would just quickly disagree on your notion that the NRA wasn't helpful in the McDonald litigation. There were four votes on the NRA theory, one vote on the guerrilla privileges or immunities theory, and it took the team to both do it and both to separately argue it. And you didn't discuss the oral argument, but in contrast to the Heller oral argument, where I was one of the assisting Allen at the council table, and Justice Scalia was very nice to him and helped him out and says, well, what you mean to say is things like that. He ripped into Allen immediately and quite nastily. It was like he was very offended that Allen was even arguing privileges or immunities, which seems kind of unfair because they did grant cert and ask the question. You know, it was the question. But anyway, the rest of the court, except for Justice Thomas, who doesn't speak very often to oral arguments, was also quite hostile to oral argument. And as described by the nation's greatest Supreme Court reporter, Lyle Dennison, the justices were quite hostile to not only Allen, also the Chicago lawyer who had an untenable position given the extremist position his client wanted to argue, and they were relieved when the NRA's attorney, Paul Clement, got up to argue and just gave them the good old-fashioned due process, very standard presidential thing. Don't worry too much about, you know, the original meaning, and that's what they want. And so it was the combination of Allen's unorthodox and correct historical approach and the NRA's more conventional precedential approach that were necessary together to that victory.
The NRA was superfluous. Allen briefed, with due respect both to you, Dave, and the NRA, Allen briefed the substantive due process stuff. It was in all the briefings. I mean, indeed, you didn't need the NRA to tell the justice how to do that. A bright 1L or an average 2L to write that opinion in their sleep.
Or Cato Winter.
Or Cato Winter. Well, no, that's above an average 2L. So. Yeah, okay, but so what I'm saying is they didn't need, I mean, however hostile they were to Allen, if in the absence of the NRA, Scalia, Alito, Roberts, Kennedy were not going to all of a sudden agree with Chicago. And Allen was, perfectly, he presented both sides as any good lawyer was, and he argued both sides, and, who knows why they wanted Paul Clement to
Yeah, but did Thomas need Allen to tell him about the Privileges or Immunities Clause?
So I guess we didn't need an oral argument at all.
I'm going to end it. And I will say that Nelson Lund, and anybody who doesn't know Nelson Lund, you got a false invite.
Yeah.
Nelson Lund's comment was, McDonald was decided as soon as they granted cert.
Yeah.
So did they need oral arguments? Let's ask Nelson. I repeat, McDonald was decided as soon as they granted cert.
Yeah.
So at any rate, thank you very much. Before next up, there's somebody here I want to introduce. There aren't a whole lot of women here. There aren't a whole lot of women involved in this issue. And Sandy Papa, that is Sandy Frohman, who is a Harvard Law grad, and more important to what I'm saying, from 2005 to 2007, she was the president of the National Latin Association. So there are women involved in this issue. Thank you, Alice.